The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
As the war in Ukraine drags on, will Washington and American taxpayers lose interest? The U.S. ambassador to Ukraine weighs in and says, nope.
This is ultimately a fight for freedom. It's also a moral question.
Also ahead, some Afghans take an indirect route to try to get to the U.S. They're crossing Panama's jungles. This father is focused on his daughter's education.
Everyone in the world knows that schools and universities are closed in Afghanistan. So I don't want my child to be uneducated.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Plus, professional women's basketball arrives in Canada. The WNBA may have only one preseason game there, but it's still a big deal.
Being able to experience the live game is a memory people have forever.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. After months of stalemate, Ukraine's military says it's gaining ground in the embattled southern city of Bakhmut. In recent days, Russian troops have pulled back and Ukrainian forces have advanced more than a mile. That's according to Ukrainian officials. The Russian Defense Ministry denies this. The World's Daniel Offman is in Kyiv and is on the line with me now. Daniel, is this push in Bakhmut part of this long-awaited spring offensive from Ukraine?
Well, Carolyn, it's still unclear, and we're getting some mixed messages. Some Russian sources, including Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of the Wagner private military company, say Ukraine's expected counteroffensive is now underway. But Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said yesterday that Kyiv is delaying its long-awaited counteroffensive. He said Ukraine is still waiting to receive more armored vehicles and other weapons, so we're still waiting for some clarity.
Daniel, you just had a chance to sit down with the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine earlier today to talk about the war and U.S. support. What did she say?
That's right, Carolyn. I spoke with Ambassador Bridget Brink. I met with her at the U.S. Embassy here in Kyiv. And among other topics, we spoke about the Ukrainian counteroffensive. And there's been a lot of speculation about it. So I asked her to describe what she's looking for and expecting from the counteroffensive.
I would just say that it is one aspect of this war, and I think it's important for us to put it in the perspective of our efforts to enable Ukraine to push out and fight against the Russians that have invaded this country, that have tried to change the borders of Ukraine by force. So I think that there will be a more kinetic period as the counteroffensive continues and moves into this phase. We also spent the whole winter in a very kinetic period where we actually had to move to bunkers almost 30 times because of massive missile and drone strikes. And I anticipate that we will just continue to do what we're doing, which is to support Ukraine in every way possible so that they can continue to liberate and take back their territory.
How do you, and by extension, the United States, define victory for Ukraine?
Well, President Biden has said all along that it will be up to President Zelensky as to when he decides to stop fighting, and that all negotiations, all wars eventually come to some kind of end. And that decision is with the elected representative, the president of this country, and that our job is to support Ukraine in every way possible to enable them to take back as much territory as possible. So when they do get to that point, they're in the best possible position at the negotiating table.
And are you concerned about war fatigue back in the United States?
I can say that from the level and frequency of visitors that we get here from our own government, our president, 9 members of our cabinet, a multitude of people under that level, as well as 40-plus members of Congress, I see no break in support and desire to ensure that we do everything possible to help Ukraine prevail.
Still, Americans are very familiar with long and drawn-out wars. Are you worried that after a certain amount of time,
People will say, okay, how long is this going to go on? What are the results of our taxpayer money going here to Ukraine?
It's certainly a question. But what I would say, and being here, is that this war is very important, of course, to the Ukrainians. It's an existential fight for their future, for their freedom. But it also is very important to the United States for many reasons. Number one, our longstanding principle, and something which I have been a public servant for over 25 years promoting, is in support of freedom. This is ultimately a fight for freedom. Number two, it's also a moral question to support Ukraine against what is a clear example of attacks on a country, attacks on not just a military attack, but attacks on people such as the critical civilian infrastructure, the energy grid, which would affect millions of people, sexual violence at a level we have not seen in Europe in a very long time, attacks which include stealing children from their families and filtrating them to Russia, attacks which include war crimes and atrocities that are unspeakable and not anything that we have seen since World War II in Europe. So I would say that the moral clarity of this is also a very important point and something that Americans really understand. I also believe there are tremendous impacts to this war on the economic side. So obviously there's the grain impact, which is influencing and increasing prices of wheat around the world. But there also is the impact on energy and energy prices and Russia's use of energy as a weapon. In addition to even the economic impacts, there are ways in which Russia is fighting this war on the disinformation side, not just in Ukraine, but in Europe and also in America, which are very dangerous to our democracy. And then finally, there's a strategic reason that ultimately is very important to us in the United States. And that is, if we allow Russia to change borders by force, it potentially opens up instability all around the world.
Wars, armed conflicts, they tend to end at the negotiating table. How will the U.S. know that it's time to negotiate?
So President Biden has said that it's up to President Zelensky to decide when he would start negotiations. That time isn't yet.
Is the U.S. making plans, though, in order to aid Ukraine in negotiations, facilitate negotiations? Because at a certain point, this likely will happen.
I would say that we are in support of Ukrainian vision on the future. And so we will do what we can to support them when that time comes.
So we've seen this trend. We've seen time after time Ukraine asking for howitzers, then HIMARS. And after some time, the U.S. would end up providing these weapons that the U.S. beforehand was reluctant to provide. So why the lagging behind? If Ukraine says we need weapon X in order to be successful on the battlefield, why this kind of lag in the U.S. providing the weapons that they ask for?
I mean, I would maybe look at it in a little different way, that I think we have provided something, I think, along the lines of $36 billion worth of security assistance in the last year in a very fast and dynamic fashion, in a way that is more than any other partner. So I'm quite proud of what we have provided, to include advanced weaponry that was not something that was even being considered, you know, a couple years ago. So I think we've been extraordinarily fast and extraordinarily nimble.
How about when it comes to F-16s? This is something that President Zelensky has been very vocal about in terms of fighter jets. Has the U.S. moved when it comes to F-16s or other fighter jets that the Ukrainians are asking for?
I can say that under discussion are many different capabilities, and also under discussion is how and when we could provide or support various capabilities for the Ukrainians. And so obviously it's a lot to take on in one time, but I am very proud of what we've been able to provide, and I know that we will continue to adapt as the Ukrainian battlefield requires.
As you've noted, the U.S. has provided tens of billions of dollars in support, military support, but just regular aid as well. How do you make sure that that money is used wisely and is accounted for?
Well, from day one, accountability for all U.S. assistance has been and is one of my very top priorities. It's something I publicly said when I was first credentialed by the president, and something that I have a whole team of people working on here. Essentially, we are required by law and regulation to take certain steps to account for U.S. assistance. And I can say that I work closely with my team to make sure that we are doing everything that we can. In addition, we have multiple offices of the Inspector General who also advise us and oversee us as well as the Ukrainians. And this is how we are making sure that every penny of taxpayer assistance is being used in an appropriate way, as intended.
Ambassador Brink, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Bridget Brink speaking with The World's Daniel Offman in Kyiv earlier today. Toronto is hockey territory, home to Canada's much-beloved Maple Leafs and the Hockey Hall of Fame. But in 2019...
Canada!
The Toronto Raptors won the NBA championship and turned the city into a basketball town. Now, the WNBA is getting in on the action. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Four years ago, Leah McNabb took her six-year-old son to a Raptors game.
And he mentioned how he'd love to see women play.
There is no WNBA team up north, though. So without crossing the border, McNabb's son was out of luck. But fortunately for him, Mom McNabb is in charge of the NBA and WNBA's growth in Canada. She quickly got to work.
I thought, you know what, this is something my team could bring to life.
The league was ready to announce the first ever WNBA game in Canada in early 2020. Then the pandemic hit. 3 years later, it's finally happening. The Chicago Sky and Minnesota Lynx will face off tomorrow at Toronto's Scotiabank Arena, where the Raptors play. The nearly 20,000-seat stadium is sold out. McNabb says the pandemic-induced pause on the game ended up working in the league's favor. In the past 3 years,
the WNBA, the popularity, the interest, all increased dramatically.
Broadcast ratings grew by 95%. Social media numbers and merchandise sales are up, too. McNabb hopes this weekend's game will help grow the fan base even more by introducing the WNBA to Canadians.
Being able to experience a live game is a memory people have forever. Everyone remembers their first live sporting event. And for, you know, little girls and boys to see women on the court will be an impactful moment.
McNabb is excited to experience that moment with her kids on Saturday. So is Laura Porter Clausen. She's taking her two daughters to the game.
It's exciting, you know, for any sports team to come to Toronto, but it's especially when it's like women's basketball. It's nice to see women, you know, in the spotlight for a change because it doesn't happen often.
Porter Clausen's daughters grew up playing basketball and follow WNBA players online, especially the Canadian stars like Kia Nurse, who happens to be from their hometown of Hamilton, Ontario. What the Porter Clausen household would really like to see is a more permanent WNBA presence close to home.
The whole Southern Ontario is a very basketball area. It thrives. So a female WNBA team would definitely do well here. So I'm hoping, you know, this kind of tests the water a little bit. Maybe they'll send a team our way.
Many fans on social media are hoping for the same. McNabb says she loves how excited people are, but declined to comment on specific plans. League Commissioner Kathy Engelbert has made global expansion a pillar of her tenure, though, as she detailed in a press conference last fall.
WNBA games currently air in 207 countries and territories. We know there's a great appetite to see WNBA action live, and we're looking forward to bringing the W to our fans across the globe.
Engelbert has since said that WNBA expansion remains 2 to 4 years away. For now, fans in Toronto have tomorrow's game to tide them over. Tip-off for the Sky Lynx matchup is at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Stay with us. There's much more news coming your way. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Across Turkey, candidates are making their final pleas to voters before Sunday's presidential election. The country's leader of 20 years, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is facing a robust challenge from six opposition parties. They've all united behind a candidate with a promise to return the country to democracy. The World's Duri Buscarin reports.
Near a ferry terminal in central Istanbul, teams of volunteers are ready to make their case to any unsure voter who wanders their way. We see this election as the last possible exit before the bridge for Turkish democracy, says Ahmet Oktar, who's supporting Turkish opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Turkey has already lost 20 years, Oktar says. We can't afford to lose another five. While in power, Erdogan has stripped away many of the checks and balances that used to exist in the Turkish government. He's used a judiciary loyal to him to imprison and intimidate journalists and political rivals. So for many, this election feels existential. But Erdogan still enjoys broad support.
Erdogan.
He provides everything for us, says Afife Yağcı, a housewife who moved to Istanbul from a small town near the Black Sea 50 years ago. She raises her arms up to demonstrate. Just look around you. Hospitals, airplanes, the metro line, the ferries, she says. The city's full of these things. Erdogan has focused his campaign on national security and Turkey's military might. In speeches, he regularly accuses the opposition of ties to the PKK, a Kurdish militant group accused of bombing a busy street in Istanbul last fall, killing six. In contrast, Kılıçdaroğlu's promises to return to orthodox economic policies and respect human rights feel almost gentle. But in the days leading up to the election, the longtime opposition leader and anti-corruption campaigner has pulled ahead of Erdogan in the polls. Many voters say they just want change. Ismail Çetin spent 4 years studying physics at one of Turkey's top universities. Today, he sells stuffed mussels, a popular street food, because it's the only job he can get. I should be working in labs or teaching, maybe. But I have to work here, and I probably make less than minimum wage, Çetin says. He sees Turkey's spiraling economy as the result of Erdogan's rule. At a train station nearby, passengers wait with suitcases in tow. Almost everyone is required to vote in person in Turkey. So for college students like Asla Arabua, they'll journey back to their hometown to cast a ballot. I believe that the candidate that I want to vote for needs my support, so I'm going to Ankara, Arabua says. She says she'll vote for Erdogan because he promises to bring down rent costs in Istanbul. The president has been in power for as long as Arabua has been alive. But this election has been particularly hard. People are so tense. I see people fighting each other, and I think the politics are affecting everyone, Arabua says. Even in my own family, we had arguments. Many won't be able to make that trip. An estimated 2 million voters have been displaced by the earthquakes this winter, and many weren't able to re-register their addresses. Election rights groups and the government have offered reimbursements for tickets home. At Türkiye Gönüllüleri, a voting rights group tied to the opposition campaign, volunteers work the phones. Volunteer Esra Akal, who helps coordinate the program, says their poll watchers will be spread out across 73 of Turkey's 81 provinces to check the final ballot counts to guard against fabricated results. No matter what happens, no matter what the outcome of the election is, we want to protect the voters' will and have a fair and democratic election, she says. Initial results from the first round of votes are expected Sunday night. If no candidate wins more than half the vote, the election will go to a runoff 2 weeks later. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin in Istanbul.
Moldovans in antler hats, Croatians stripping, glitter, leather, and lots of camp. It's Eurovision time. The winner of the international song competition will be crowned on Saturday. Personally, I've never watched Eurovision, and I hadn't even heard of it until I started working here. But that is why we have the world's Sarah Birnbaum. She reports on Finland's entry to Eurovision, Cha-Cha-Cha by Carja.
This is the song, and we'll get to that in a minute. But first, I need to talk about Carja's costume. He's bare-chested, and then he's wearing this neon green bolero jacket thingy. So, you know those floaties kids wear on their arms to swim? Like, imagine three of them on each arm. Or think of the Hulk with his green muscles. That's what it looks like. The Finns have a nickname for it. They call it Kalimato, which means cabbage worm. Back in March, Carja lost the jacket. It fell out of his trunk on the way to a gig. He put out this APB on Instagram asking for help finding it.
No nyt on kärtsäripojalla vähän kyynel silmillä ja tatti otassa, että jos oot Malmin päällä liikkunut ja löytänyt semmoisen...
You can feel the pain. And just in case you can't, he wrote, I feel as if a piece of my heart is missing. Turns out a family found it in a garment bag at the side of the road, so the man and the jacket were one again. Carja brought the mom flowers and everything. It would not be an exaggeration to say that Finland is obsessed with this jacket. There's a bolero filter on TikTok. The stone statues at the Helsinki train station are wearing versions of it. Even Finland's political parties released logos incorporating the bolero into the design. Little kids, like 8, 9 years old, are wearing the jackets to play dress up. And this is the best. A BBC reporter interviewed a Carja superfan in a green bolero jacket because she thought it was Carja.
And we even managed to catch up with the main man himself.
To his credit, the random guy being interviewed went along with it. Finns are completely losing their minds for Carja, and it's not just the jacket. The song Cha-Cha-Cha starts out like industrial metal, and then halfway through completely switches gears to something that sounds like K-pop. The lyrics are about tossing back a few drinks after a hard day, and the staging, the dancing, the whole thing. There are almost no words, just shocked reactions online.
Ooh, I love the sound.
I'm a bit scared.
This is mental.
If I had to describe the performance, I'd say it's like a fever dream that you can't wake up from, but you also don't want to. Everything Eurovision should be. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're with the world. Deep in outer space, an explosion astronomers are calling unprecedented.
So for this one, we could maybe call it the LOAT, the largest of all time.
Get it? Like the goat? Learn exactly what happens when a cloud of gas gets sucked into a black hole. Plus, an international shout out to moms for Mother's Day. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Israel is once again battling Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip. But it's not Hamas that the Israeli military is tangling with. It's the group Islamic Jihad. Islamic Jihad has fired more than 900 rockets into Israel in recent days. Most have been intercepted. Meanwhile, Israel has targeted the organization's leaders in Gaza with airstrikes. The fighting has killed at least 33 Palestinians, including civilian women and children. One Israeli has been killed as of Friday afternoon. So just what is Islamic Jihad? We reached out to Isabel Debray, a Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press in Jerusalem. Isabel, let's focus now on Islamic Jihad. When was the group founded and for what purpose?
Islamic Jihad was officially formed in 1981. It was this radical Islamist movement that was aimed at resisting Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So in that way, it's very similar to the better known Hamas movement, which actually emerged several years later. During the First Intifada, Hamas became way more prominent and bigger than Islamic Jihad. But importantly, both groups were aligned in their rejection of peace talks with Israel. They did not want a Palestinian state alongside Israel, whereas the Palestine Liberation Organization was pursuing that during what was called the Oslo peace process.
So you mentioned how Islamic Jihad started in kind of a similar way as Hamas. How is it different now these days?
So key differences between Hamas and Islamic Jihad really emerged after 2007, and that was when Hamas seized control of the Gaza Strip after winning a plurality in the Palestinian parliamentary elections. And after that, Israel and Egypt launched this blockade against Gaza, and that continues actually to this day, 16 years later. So Hamas became a de facto government at that point, and Islamic Jihad was not. Islamic Jihad did not have to worry about governing, whereas Hamas had 2 million people under its control and really abysmal conditions that just kept worsening under this blockade after several rounds of conflict with Israel.
To what extent are these two groups rivals and to what extent do they cooperate?
You know, Israel is their common enemy. It's their hated enemy. And they do, you know, join forces at times. But what has happened more recently, particularly in the last year, because we saw this happen in August of 2022, is that Islamic Jihad takes it upon itself to strike Israel. And in response, Israel tries to limit its targets to Islamic Jihad because it doesn't want to involve Hamas. If Israel involves Hamas, it's only going to mean a more violent escalation. That's going to mean more civilian deaths. And that's going to also increase international scrutiny of Israel, which is not necessarily what it wants if it's, you know, already achieved its military objectives.
Egypt and Qatar are trying to broker a ceasefire between Palestinian factions and Israel. What do we know about those efforts so far?
We know that there are negotiations in Cairo. We know that Egypt says it's involved. We know Qatar and the United Nations say they're involved. We know that they say they're trying to exert as much pressure as possible. We know that Hamas is saying that it's involved, that it's trying to talk to Egypt about this. And that's about it, because honestly, we have not seen any outcome of these talks so far. The latest was that Israeli public broadcaster Khan said that Israel had withdrawn from the talks after the latest Islamic Jihad rocket fire toward Jerusalem, which was a bit of an escalation. And now, as of a couple of hours ago, we had Israeli airstrikes kill another Islamic Jihad commander in a targeted killing. So it seems like Israel is not responding to those conditions that Islamic Jihad has set out. So it's really going to take a matter of time to see, you know, what happens there.
On a different note for today, the Israeli Defense Forces apologized for the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh a year after her death. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So you had the Israeli military spokesperson saying this to CNN. It was not a public statement that they came out and apologized for it. So Shireen's family has said, you know what, this is not justice. And they are trying to push, you know, the United States, they're trying to push others to put more pressure on Israel to give some sort of justice, some sort of reparation for her death. But this shows that there is this sort of increasing pressure that's making a difference in the Israeli military. There is the sense that they have to express contrition because this consensus that they are responsible for her death is building.
Isabel Debray is a Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press. She joined us from Jerusalem. Thank you so much, Isabel.
Thank you.
All week, we've been covering the situation at the U.S.-Mexico border as a key pandemic-era asylum policy expires. We've also been following the path that many migrants take, including crossing the dangerous Darien jungle that connects South to Central America. Most who attempt the crossing are South American, but some migrants have already traveled quite far to get there. Manuel Rueda reports from Colombia.
At the small pier in Necoclí, hundreds of migrants get ready to board speedboats that will take them towards the border with Panama. This is one of the last stops in Colombia before the trek across the Darien jungle begins. So some migrants wear rubber boots, while others pack their luggage in plastic bags that they seal with tape to protect their things from the rain. Most people around here speak Spanish or Haitian Creole, but there's a group at the edge of the crowd speaking in Dari. They've come all the way from Afghanistan. I asked them how they ended up so far from home.
In this world, no one helps us. You know, we're trying our best to reach somewhere, to have a safety life for our family, kids, children, you know.
Abdul Baez leads a group of three families. While many migrants are carrying backpacks, he hauls around a leather briefcase with his documents. He says that he's worried about his daughter's education.
Everyone in the world knows that the door of schools and universities are closed in Afghanistan. So therefore, I mentioned that it's impossible. So I don't want my child be uneducated. Don't have that things in Afghanistan. There's no human rights.
Baez used to be a diplomat, and his family led a comfortable life in Iran, where he worked at Afghanistan's embassy. But things began to change when the Taliban took over Afghanistan. Baez and his family could not go back to Kabul because their lives would be at risk there. So they stayed in Iran, where they had diplomatic visas.
We were on a duty when the government changed in Afghanistan. After 8 months, we were in embassy. We were working normally.
But in February, Iran's government handed Afghanistan's embassy to the Taliban regime. Baez was stripped of his diplomatic status and was forced to leave the country.
How many days did they give you to leave Iran?
Around 1 week. They took our passport and they canceled our residency and I give exit visa that in 1 week you have to leave.
Baez asked for help at different embassies and was able to secure a humanitarian visa to Brazil. So in March, he flew to Sao Paulo with his family. A month later, they were in Necoclí, Colombia, making plans to cross the Darien Gap.
We will walk the baby and luggage we will put on horse. Then we will walk around with the horses.
Baez and his family aren't the only Afghans making this long trek across Latin America. According to Panama's Immigration Authority, more than 3,000 refugees from Afghanistan have crossed the Darien jungle since August of 2021, when the Taliban took over the country. Most start their journey in Brazil, which has already taken in 5,000 Afghans who were stuck in Iran and other countries and have been unable to get visas to fly to the United States. Miguel Coy volunteers for the Frente Afegã, an organization that helps Afghans who arrive in Sao Paulo's airport.
They were people that somehow are attached to the American affairs back in Afghanistan, to the American government employers, to the American businessmen.
Brazil has offered to provide work permits and residency to Afghans who arrive in the country on humanitarian visas. But it's a lengthy process, and many struggle with the language barriers and red tape. Coy says that 90% of the Afghans who arrive in Brazil eventually travel to the U.S. border.
They have the conception that in America they will rebuild their lives more easy, more quickly, because it has more jobs and the jobs pay more. That's the main reasons that they leave Brazil, because they cannot find jobs here that easily by themselves.
But the journey north isn't easy. And some humanitarian groups are reporting that criminal gangs in Latin America are targeting Afghans. Rafael Velasquez is the Mexico country director for the International Rescue Committee. His organization runs a community center that is helping Afghans who are passing through Mexico City.
We had situations where we were informed of Afghan people that were moving towards the border, and in that transit, they were detained and kidnapped. Many of these people have higher levels of education, have some resources, but don't speak the language, making them prime targets, unfortunately, for organized crime.
A week after I met Abdul Baez at the entrance to the Darien Gap, I decided to see how far he's made it and whether he was safe.
Hello, how are you doing?
Thank you, thanks. How about you?
He tells me he's in Tapachula on Mexico's southern border, trying to get a visa to get across the country. His group was robbed by policemen in Guatemala, who took three phones away from them and more than $1,000 in cash. Still, Baez says he will press on to the U.S. border, where his family plans to ask for asylum and try their luck with the new policies.
We don't have any second option to stay somewhere. We have to reach there.
He says that they've already passed the point of no return. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogota.
In some places, there's a single iconic fashion item that represents a whole country. In Romania, that would be the Ia. Henri Matisse has a famous painting with a woman wearing one. Yves Saint Laurent and Oscar de la Renta dedicated collections to it. But all the attention has led to a huge trade in cheap imported replicas. And as The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, there are fears this could put the traditional industry in Romania out of business.
Inside a nondescript building in Bucharest, a small woman, no more than 5 foot, is sitting behind a large loom. This is Mariana Naxu. She takes the spool of white silk thread and weaves it methodically around the wooden loom.
12 ore, da, aici. 7 zile pe săptămână.
She works here 12 hours a day, she says, 7 days a week, making the ia, that's the traditional Romanian blouse. The garments are usually loose-fitting with intricately embroidered patterns along the front and the sleeves. Naxu says it can take anywhere from 6 months to more than a year to make just one. The workshop is the only one of its kind here in Bucharest, but it wasn't always like this.
In the 60s and 70s, Romanian blouse was the front runner of the hippie movement. And all these blouses were made in Romania.
This is Andreea Tanasescu. She's the founder of La Blouse Horman, a group that promotes the traditional blouse. We're talking in a tea room in Bucharest. Tanasescu says the ia was popular in Romania right up until the end of the 1980s, then communism collapsed.
In the 90s, you know, the younger generation, they want to embrace the Western culture, like we saw on MTV. And all these workshops, they become, you know, the things of the past.
In 2012, fashion designer Tom Ford came up with a new top inspired by the Romanian blouse, and singer Adele appeared on the front cover of Vogue wearing it. Interest in the blouse spiked again. But this time, Tanasescu says, it sparked a huge industry of cheap knockoffs from China and India. The original handmade blouse costs anywhere from $150 to more than $2,000. Tanasescu says you can find the imported copies in any of the outdoor markets in Bucharest. So I head to Obermarket in the northeast of the city with my Romanian producer Raul Steff.
So I'm just coming up to a stall now, and this woman has some of the traditional blouses hanging up. So let's see what she has to say.
Are they the authentic Romanian blouse?
Da,
yeah, she says they're traditional.
And they're made here in...
Yeah? Yes. Oh.
It says Ind here. What's it? In, is Ind not India?
She says that's how the thing is, but she says they're Romanian.
Hmm. What price are they?
Cât costă una?
120 la 100.
100 lei.
That's about $22 for a blouse, supposedly handmade, here in Romania, although the label indicates it's made in India. Back at the workshop, I ask Mariana Naxu how she feels about the imported copies being sold in local markets here in Bucharest.
Asta e piața. Fiecare cumpără.
That's the way it goes, she says, shrugging her shoulders. Everyone buys what they can afford. Last December, UNESCO included the Romanian blouse on a list of what it calls intangible cultural heritage. Andreea Tanasescu, who's joined us in the workshop, says in spite of all that, the Romanian government still shows no interest in protecting the authentic ia. And there's a reason for this, she says.
Here it's about money, in my opinion. Because at the end of the day, the copies are bringing more money on the taxes.
The stall holders pay taxes to the government. As we talk, 6 or 7 women arrive in the workshop. They're all wearing the traditional blouses. Tanasescu says they come here every Friday to sew the blouses and to chat. They sit around a large wooden table working on the embroidery.
So everyone is sewing now, but what do you talk about in the group?
90% of their time they are talking about the blouses, the embroidery, the techniques, and 10% they are talking about something else.
We're not discussing love lives and family scandals and politics and...
That.
Anisescu says there's health benefits to this kind of labour too.
It's like a form of meditation. It's like doing yoga with your mind. It's very therapeutic.
Very therapeutic. Now, she says, you can see why we want this homegrown industry to thrive. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Bucharest, Romania.
Now we've got two updates about different kinds of talking. First, to Vienna, where the U.S. and China are engaged in high-level discussions. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the Biden administration is looking to move beyond tensions caused by that Chinese spy balloon kerfuffle and create more reliable lines of communication. The White House described the discussions as candid and constructive. Talk number two is in Saudi Arabia, where warring factions from Sudan are meeting. The UN envoy for Sudan welcomed a deal that promises safe passage to civilians fleeing the nearly month-long conflict and protection for humanitarian operations in Sudan. The UN envoy said the agreement was an important first step toward a ceasefire. Astronomers say they've detected the largest explosion ever witnessed, thought to be triggered by an enormous cloud of gas being sucked into a black hole. Astronomer Philip Wiseman at Southampton University was part of the team that detected this explosion. Phil, tell me more about what happened.
Yes, so it actually kind of snuck in through the back door, so to speak. The explosion was discovered by a telescope in California, which just detected it in routine observations of the night sky. And then we picked it up with larger telescopes where we were able to measure a distance to it. And once you know the distance to something and the brightness that it appears, you work out how bright it actually must be. And with that information, we could then work out that this was one of the brightest things we had ever seen.
And so what did cause this? Can you tell me more about the black hole and the gas?
So what we believe to be the case is perhaps a giant cloud of gas that has effectively been partly shredded by the supermassive black hole. Then there's some kind of shock from that shredding that propagates through this cloud, and that is glowing at about 12,000 centigrade at a size of 100 times the size of the solar system.
If I were, say, out in a spaceship at a safe distance from this explosion, what would this have looked like to witness?
It would have been actually quite slow. This has taken 3 years so far. It's still visible. So you could have sat there with popcorn and a nice cool drink and watched it gradually get larger and brighter. And actually, we think it probably started off quite blue in color and probably gradually changed through to a kind of slightly redder color as time goes on.
And if I were sitting there with my popcorn watching this explosion, I wouldn't hear anything, right? Because there's no sound in space?
Exactly. The vast majority of space is an empty vacuum where you can't have sound traveling because you need matter to convey sound. So despite it being extremely large and very cool to watch, you wouldn't hear a thing.
You said this has been going on for 3 years. Is it still happening, or is it one of those things that's over, but the light is just now reaching us here on Earth?
Yeah, exactly that. I say it's still happening. The light is still being detected on Earth, but in actual fact, this happened about 8 billion years ago, so before even the Earth was formed. And it's only reaching us now because it was so far away that the light has taken that much time to travel to reach us.
So 8 billion light years away.
Correct, yes.
Wow. How common is this kind of event? I mean, this sounds like it's exceptionally large, but is this kind of event happening every day?
So stars falling onto black holes, stars that are like our sun, happen several times a year. So it's not every day, but we do witness them semi-regularly. This explosion is much more violent. There have been recordings of a handful that look somewhat similar that can't really be described by a single star falling onto a black hole or by a steady stream. but none of those are as bright as this one that we found now. This one is at least two or three times brighter than any of those.
Hmm. So the nickname for the explosion that kicked off the start of the universe is the Big Bang. The name for this explosion, I gather, is, I have it in front of me, AT2021LWX. Is there any snappier nickname in the works for this one?
So this doesn't roll off the tongue so well. Actually, in 2022, there was a brighter explosion. So this is much larger. The brighter explosion was a gamma ray burst. It happened for a much shorter duration, which is why the explosion itself is not so big. But in the instant, it was brighter. And that has become known as the BOAT, or the brightest of all time. So for this one, we could maybe call it the LOAT, the largest of all time.
Goat, boat, loat. I like it. We've been speaking to Philip Weissman. He's an astronomer and researcher at Southampton University in the United Kingdom. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A touching moment caught on camera at a school in Kenya is going around the internet this week. It shows Joyce Mallett, a teacher, sewing the dress of an 8-year-old student. The girl's dress ripped on a nail as she walked past her teacher's desk. While another teacher supplied a cloth to cover the student, Miss Mallett pulled out her needle and thread. A moment of nurturing that adults everywhere would recognize. Which brings us today to our final note. The U.S. and some three dozen other countries are celebrating Mother's Day this Sunday. Mama, I dedicate this song to you. We asked some of our team here at The World to share their greetings to their moms.
My name is Joshua Coe. I produce stories for The World, and today I wanted to wish my mom, Lucy Coe, a Glædelig Morsdag from Denmark.
My name is Tivis Isaiah, and I want to send a big hug to my mom, Clara. Feliz Día de las Madres, mamá.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm an editor here at The World, wishing a Feliz Día de las Mães para minha mãe querida, Sileji Gross.
Eu te amo, vovozinha.
This is Matthew Bell. In China, they also celebrate Mother's Day in May, so Muqin Jie Kuai Le.
This is Shirin Jafari, and I grew up in Iran, where Happy Mother's Day is Ruza Madar Mubarak.
This is Duri Buskarin in Istanbul. My mom, June Buskarin, is in northern Colorado, and I'd like to wish her an Anneler Günün Kutlu Olsun in Turkish.
My name is Azair Ahmed. I'm an audio engineer at The World. I grew up in Pakistan. Hey mom, it's your day. Let's celebrate. Amma, aaj aapka din hai. Aapko bahut bahut mubarak ho.
Mama, I dedicate this song to you.
This is Sarah Birnbaum, and I'm wishing Happy Mother's Day to my mom, Barbara, in French. Joyeuse fête des mères, maman.
My name is Omar Dwaji. I produce stories for The World. Happy Mother's Day in Arabic is Kul aam wa kull al ummahat bi khair.
Hello, I'm Nasibe. I'm an intern at The World. I'm from Albania, and in Albanian, Happy Mother's Day is Gëzuar ditën e nënës.
Hey, it's Marco, and I'm saying in Dutch, Gelukkig Moederdag, to my mother, who is Dutch. And of all the many things I have to pronounce, that may be the toughest, mom.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler, wishing really the very best mom ever, Nan Beeler, Happy Mother's Day. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be good to each other, and we'll see you back here on Monday.